And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio 1. And welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. And remember, we shine only when we make you shine. John Hall's path is optimistic. As a professional performer, singer, songwriter, guitarist, he found himself wanting and needing to make changes to better the world around him. By advocacy through music, he segued into politics, first on a local level, and then nationally as a member of the United States Congress. After making a difference for the environment, healthcare, and even more so for veterans, he returned to the music world. John's memoir, Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back, shares a variety of stories from his life in the musical and political worlds. Best known as a member of Orleans, a hit-making pop rock group with multiple lead singers and hits Still the One, Dance With Me, both co-written by John and still in heavy use on the radio, streamers, Broadway shows, and TV shows like Maya and Marty and Hallmark's Movie of the Week. Still and Dance have been certified by BMI at over 12 million airplays in the U.S. alone. Other Orleans hits include Love Takes Time, Let There Be Music, and Reach. John Hall has written songs for music legends ranging from Janis Joplin and Bonnie Raitt, and to Chet Atkins. Other folks that have covered John's songs include Bobby McFerrin, the Doobie Brothers with James Taylor and Michael McDonald, Bella Fleck with Newgrass Revival and Ricky Skaggs and James Taylor. He wrote Miss Grace, number one in England, by The Times in 1975, and listed in Rolling Stone's top five of all-time beach music hits. John played guitar on record and or on tour with Seals and Crofts, Taj Mahal, Carly Simon, Little Feat, and Christopher Cross. His environmental concerns led him into community activism as one of the movers of the anti-nuclear movement. John co-founded the activist group MUSE, Musicians United for Safe Energy, with Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Graham Nash in 1979. His song Power became the rallying song and a highlight at the Five No Nukes concerts presented by MUSE in 1979. Among the artists that participated, Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, the Doobie Brothers, James Taylor, Gil Scott-Heron, Crosby, Stills & Nash, Chaka Khan, Carly Simon, Tom Petty, and Jackson Brown, to name a few. Starting in 1990, John served in the Ulster County, New York Legislature and the Socrates, New York Board of Education. In 2006, he ran for Congress against an entrenched incumbent in a historically Republican district. John's musical colleagues performing at fundraisers made it possible to finance his winning campaign for the U.S. House of Representatives, for whom he served until early 2011. In Still the One, John shares stories about moments that stand out from both his musical and political lives. John shares childhood memories of being raised to be an optimist and finding himself at age 18 in the miles of the 60s music explosion. And Still the One shows the cresting of his passion for environmental issues and rolling up his sleeves to help build several environmental groups. From Janis Joplin's birthday party to conversations behind the closed-door caucus in the basement of the Capitol, from dialogue with protesters to sharing elevator rides with fellow members of Congress, this captivating memoir offers viewpoints from an earnest and humorous voice. John Hall's life path is jammed packed with intriguing stories, fascinating people, and optimism. Titled after John's best-known song, Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back, is ultimately an ode to engagement in creating a better world. Available now at Amazon.com. Would you please welcome to the Ray Shasho Show, guitarist, singer, songwriter, congressman, and author, Mr. John Hall.
Hey, Ray. Good to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you very much. Boy, you have a lot of titles going on nowadays, huh? I mean, what's next?
I know. It's kind of scary. But I like tangents. I've always been somebody, in terms of my own life and also in terms of music, I've always liked tangents. You know, if you write a piece of music or you're playing a solo on the guitar, it's predictable, you know, where everybody knows where you're going next. That to me, is kind of boring. And
right.
I've always liked musicians who you think, you know, they write a piece of music that you think you know where it's going to go, and then there's a twist and it goes someplace else. And the same with novels, you know, or plays. I mean, I just like surprises. And so my life has been a series of those kind of tangents. I actually was a ski instructor in the 90s for 6-7 years up at Hunter Mountain in the Catskill Mountains of New York, and licensed, certified level 2 professional ski instructors of America guy, and I taught thousands of New Yorkers how to ski. But, you know, that was just one tangent out of many, and it's primarily been a musical life for me, except for these couple of detours into politics.
Well, you're definitely a Renaissance man, I can tell you that. I mean, it's, you know, I admire a lot of artists, too, that do other things, you know, like paint. You know, a lot of artists do paint, and they're great artists, besides musically. But you know, the political thing is something I guess a lot of music artists wouldn't dare to do, you know, because it was always us against the man, you know. But you got upset and you wanted to fix something and you did something about it, which I commend you for.
On local levels, and when my daughter was in high school, and her freshman, sophomore, and junior years of high school were on austerity budget because the voters would not approve the budget that the school board had put together.
Mm-hmm.
So I was determined that she would have at least her senior year of high school on a fully funded budget, where they had decent class sizes and they had field trips and they had new band instruments or computers or whatever, you know, that they wouldn't be, she wouldn't be, and her class wouldn't be shortchanged in their last year of high school. And I wound up serving on the board for 4 years and passing budgets every year I was there. So, you know, in the first year we did it by cutting property taxes by 2%. And if you can cut taxes for whoever your constituents are, you'll reestablish trust with them. And, you know, we proved that that could be done in our school district, although a lot of people didn't think I would be the one to do it. Or, you know, I was president of the board 2 of those 4 years. And but the interesting thing about school board, Ray, is that it's the purest form of democracy that I've been involved in that you don't run as a member of a party, you run as an individual.
Yeah.
And there's no pay and there's no benefits. It's really a volunteer job. But you still have to run, you have to campaign to get elected.
Right.
And then no matter what decisions you make, if you're in office, once you're elected, people are still mad at you. So for that, you get to leave your family, your wife and children at home, and scoot out the door before having dinner and go down to the administration building and stay in a meeting that goes till past midnight. So if you have enough commitment and volunteer spirit to do all that and to take the controversy that it entails and the pressure from both sides of every issue all for nothing, or which satisfaction, I guess, is something, but there's no money involved, then, you know, I think you're really somebody who probably should go on to higher office.
Now, my daughter's a teacher, and her husband's a teacher at rival high schools. And, you know, I just see it, you know, I'm in Florida, in Manatee County. There's, you know, so many things go on within the school board. A lot of politics are involved. You know, it's always money issues, cutting back,
right,
and those types of things. And It just gets frustrating, and I think it frustrates the hell out of teachers, you know?
I'm sure it does. And yeah. You know, I'm a union member of two unions, the Musicians mm-hmm. Union and AFTRA, which is the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
Right.
And so my sort of instinctive reaction to, you know, labor management things is to side with labor, to side with the workers mm-hmm. and the employees. And when I was president of the school board, I had to sit on the other side of the table with our superintendent and the attorney for the district and negotiate contract with the representatives of the teachers' union or the custodial union or the administrators' union. And it was a really good education for me and
right.
An exercise in learning both sides of the story and
mm-hmm.
And seeing both sides of the coin. I mean, that was long before health care became the hot topic that it is now or that it was when I was in office in Congress. But even then, in the middle of the 1990s, the first thing that hit the table when negotiations began was health care.
Right.
And you could already see that it was going to be a really big issue because all of our negotiating units wanted to talk about that first before salary even was like, what are our health care benefits?
Right.
So it's been an interesting path, and one that I've enjoyed greatly and also one that I'm glad to be out of.
I understand.
Well, it's not just that politics has gotten more coarse and
yeah.
more combative and personal, I think, than when
yeah,
I
yeah.
ran in for Congress yeah. in 2006, 8, and 10.
Yeah.
But also that, you know, I've had some health problems. Everybody, when they get to be about my age,
mm-hmm.
Finds that the warranty is starting to run out, and different parts of your body may start to break down. And my family was cardiovascular genes that were the weak spot. And in 2010, when I was still in Congress, I lost my younger brother
mm-hmm.
in March to a cardiovascular crisis. And then a year later, my older brother passed away of a similar kind of illness. And then that December, my dad died, and the next January, my mom died. So in about 3 years,
mm-hmm.
starting in 2010, I lost my birth family, and my sister-in-law is a nurse, said, you know, when you go home, this was after my second brother died, my older brother, she said, you get checked out every which way and have
right.
new MRIs or CAT scans or x-rays, whatever kind of pictures you need taken, and compare them and have your doctors compare them with the old pictures
mm-hmm.
looking for change in your cardiovascular system. And so I wound up learning that I had an aneurysm in my ascending aorta, and I have now a Dacron aorta and a artificial heart valve, or aortal valve, which was right
mm-hmm.
next to it. And I think actually if I had won that election in 2010, I probably would have died on the House floor.
Yeah.
I would have been on C-SPAN late at night shaking my hand and talking about climate change or something, and
yeah.
and I would have just fallen down and been a two-day story, and
mm.
and you know, I'm much happier now with
good.
Knowing that I'm past that particular problem, and my doctors and surgeons have told me I have no limitations on physical activity, and
mm-hmm.
my dogs are happier, my wife's happier, and I think I'm happier.
Good, good. You had prostate cancer, too, didn't you?
I did, indeed. That was before.
Yeah.
That was when I was campaigning.
Right.
Right smack in the middle of the 2010 campaign, and had robotic surgery for it. And 3 days after the surgery, I marched in a Columbus Day March in
mm-hmm.
a town called Warwick in Orange County, New York, and actually, it was a three-mile march. I mean, we weren't going, well, we marched at a pretty brisk pace. I think, you know, it was had to keep up with everybody else. And any parade that has fire engines in it and school cheerleaders and, you know, marching bands and so on stops and starts up again. And it's like an accordion that stretches out and then squeezes together again. So it's not a constant pace, but still it was 3 miles. Mm-hmm. And so, fortunately, that was a quick recovery from that surgery. And, you know, I learned a little bit after being in Congress when the Affordable Care Act was being debated and formulated, and, you know, being one of those who voted for it. And I'm so happy that I did, and I'd be happy to go into any detail, you know, that anybody wants to. But basically, I got to see what it's like being on the other side of healthcare.
Exactly.
Not just my family members, but me personally, and how a health emergency is frequently how families wind up in bankruptcy.
Yep.
You know, if they're not covered or if they're underinsured, this stuff gets expensive in a big hurry. If you're not talking about any kind of cancer, or if you're talking about, you know, heart surgery or various other surgeries, and then follow-up care and the medication that might come with that and so on. It's not cheap. And so, you know, once again, as with the union and management thing on the school board, I got to see, as a legislator first, you know, the whole theoretical side of healthcare, and then as a recipient of that care, as the patient, I got to see the other side of it. So it's all been educational.
You know, my wife's a nurse also. She's been a nurse now, I don't know, 35 years, 40 years, mm-hmm. in every aspect. And, you know, if I was elected, the first thing I'd do, I'd give free health care to nurses, because to me, they really deserve it. And there's a lot of nurses out there that don't have insurance, which is a travesty, in my opinion, because, you know, these are health professionals. But, you know, I think the biggest thing with health care, in my opinion, you know, I mean, I the Obamacare, I'm personally on the Obamacare, me and my wife.
That's the Affordable Care Act, is the actual name of the law.
Exactly. But besides, I don't care what insurance you have, I just think that hospitals just charge way too much money.
So do pharmaceutical companies.
Definitely, yeah.
One of the things I wanted to be in the Affordable Care Act, and I spoke to then Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, about this, and to other members of the Democratic Caucus when we were debating it internally. I said, what I want to see is direct-to-consumer advertising be banned.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In other words, you wouldn't turn on your TV and see an ad for that little purple pill or for, you know, something to stop shaky leg syndrome or, you know, and meanwhile in the background the announcer is going on with all the terrible side effects about, you may find your eyeballs fall out and your hair starts growing and, you know, ask your doctor if this is right for you. I mean, my doctor was mad about it. He would tell me when I would go in to have a checkup, he would say, I went to medical school to learn what to prescribe for patients, and I find them now coming in asking for a particular name brand drug, mm-hmm. and if I won't give it to them, they'll find another doctor who will.
Yeah.
And it's not best practice. You know, it's frequently not appropriate for what they have. Actually, the United States and New Zealand are the only two industrialized, you know, countries of the first world, as we like to call it, that allow direct-to-consumer TV advertising.
Mm.
That cost of the making the commercials and buying the advertising time is added directly to the cost that we're charged for the medicine. And so one of the ways to cut down the cost of pharmaceuticals would be to ban direct advertising to the consumer. And it would also probably mean better care, because the docs mm-hmm. would be able to tell us, no, you don't need this, you need this one instead, or you need to eat a better diet, or you need to get more exercise, or whatever it is. You can't fix everything with a pill.
Yeah.
And so maybe the next time there's an amendment or a reform of the current law, you know, I hope it doesn't go back to the drawing board, because I think the wild west of every insurance company charging whatever the heck they wanted to charge, which was before I ran, was one of the main issues in 2006, at least here in New York, that I heard about when I was campaigning, was please do something about these incredible increases in premiums and copays. And it worked for a few years. There are other things about the Affordable Care Act that people don't know, like that it ended the congressional health care plan and required all members of Congress to buy their health care from the exchange in their home state. And that way, the theory was, and I think it's partly true, but anyway, the theory is that if members have to buy from the exchange of their home state, the insurance that covers their families and themselves, that way, if something goes wrong with it, they'll fix it.
Right.
You know, and I had lots of people when I was going around talking to folks here in the five counties, 43 municipalities, 650,000 people that I represented, people were saying, why can't I have your health care? Or why can't you have my health care? Why does it have to be different? You know, and I said, I agree with you. You know, I'll vote for something that puts us on the same health plan that you have, or vice versa. I'll take either one, I'll take. But, you know, not that there's what people used to call a gold-plated health plan for congressmen and something else for the hoi polloi. You know, I just, I've always thought that was wrong, and most people still believe that that's wrong. But that practice was stopped by the Affordable Care Act. And, in fact, this year, Paul Ryan and the Republican leadership in Congress tried to repeal just that part of the Affordable Care Act alone. So that they go back on their old, you know, government health care plan. And fortunately, that was defeated. I think in an election year, it was pretty hard to sell that to your voters that, you know, that you should vote yourself back behind the walls and let them fend for themselves on the on the market that's created by the exchanges. The other thing that most people don't know about the Affordable Care Act is that it required for the first time that insurance, health insurance companies spend at least 85% of their revenue on actual health care, on delivery of health care, or paying for medications, or paying for hospitalizations, or, you know, not on CEO bonuses or stock dividends for their shareholders, or junkets to Hawaii with doctors and salesmen to, you know, to roll out the latest new drug that they had. These things used to go on a lot, and they're going on a lot less since the medical loss ratio was put in place that requires 85% of health care insurance revenue to be spent on health care. And I've never seen, I'm living here in New York where the New York Times is kind of the paper of record, you know, and I've seen a lot of things printed about the bill, but in that supposedly liberal rag, I have never seen that covered. You know, it's one of many good things that that law did, and I hope that, like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and many other major pieces of legislation, I've always assumed that it could be amended and would be amended, and I hope that's the approach that we take. For instance, amending it by adding a public option. But you know, there are other amendments too that would help it, and those are two that, you know, well, that, you know, for instance, the advertising to directly to the consumer, I think, is a recipe for disaster.
Well, I agree with you 100%. The other thing on TV, which, you know, it was regulated at one time, and I guess against the law to do, was advertising attorneys on television, and that's gotten to be ridiculous. You know, every attorney on television advertising sets—they sound like a used car dealership. You know,
right?
And it's just too much. It's way too much competition, and you know, they're all, you know, basically you know, ambulance chasers, most of them. You know, and
Well, just, you know, I, speaking as a guy who's married to an attorney, and. Actually, my nephew is a personal injury attorney, so, but I don't think he's literally an ambulance chaser. I think he's somebody who people come to if they think they have a case.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, there are definitely attorneys, and especially the ones who advertise on TV and try to ride along on a class action that, you know, may be against victims of asbestos or victims of medical devices that turn out to be defective. And, you know, it's a tragedy already, but, you know, on the other hand, the custom and law in this country states that everybody's entitled to representation. And so, you know, you can't, I mean, it's one of the things that bothered me about some of the criticisms of Secretary Clinton is that she, you know, that she was representing somebody as a legal aid volunteer. In fact, she was ordered by a judge in Arkansas when she lived there to represent an accused rapist. And I guess most people don't know, or some people don't know, that everyone in this country, whether they turn out to be guilty or innocent, is entitled to an attorney to represent them. And there are attorneys in every town and every county who work at least part-time for legal aid and supply legal services for the indigent. And if enough people don't do it, the judges will order them to do it, as they did with Hillary. And she was just, you know, doing her duty as an officer of the court, which all attorneys are officers of the court. So, anyway, that's not to get into presidential politics, but another thing that I think is not understood by the public as well as it might.
Well, let's talk some music.
Yeah, that's always a good antidote.
You're, you and me had something in common. We were both born in Baltimore, as a matter of fact.
Well, that's interesting. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Memorial Hospital.
Well, more, I was at, oh my gosh, the Catholic Hospital.
Yeah, it's a long time ago to remember, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there are a number of good hospitals there, and so I spent a few years there, a couple years when I was a baby, and then my family moved to New Jersey and then to Elmira, New York, where I did most of my growing up. And then I went to Notre Dame University after my junior year in high school and 3 years at National Science Foundation summer programs at Assumption College in Worcester, Massachusetts. And at the age of 16, I was enrolled at Notre Dame and then quickly discovered that what I really wanted to do was play music all the time, like as close to 24 hours a day as possible. And transferred to Loyola in Baltimore, and then I didn't complete that because I found a job performing my first professional gigs. I'd done tons of frat parties and high school dances and weddings and bar mitzvahs and whatever party needed a band.
Well, I'm going to stop you there because I did read your book cover to cover.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to mention you had very interesting parents, very intelligent parents. Your mom was the first woman in the United States to attend a graduate from a Jesuit seminary, and that's incredible. Your dad did a long stint at Westinghouse, managing an imaging lab for NASA and Department of Defense project. He specialized in imaging devices, mostly classified stuff, and he was part of the team that developed the camera that took the first live pictures when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And that's just your mom and dad.
Yes, right. Right. No, they were, I appreciate them. Now that they're gone, I appreciate them much more. I mean, I did when they were alive, too, obviously. But it is pretty extraordinary. And I've also seen my dad do dead reckoning navigation on a sailboat. That would be astounding. I mean, it would seem like a magic trick, you know, if you didn't realize that he had all this math and geometry and science and electrical engineering and stuff behind him. But he could find his way in a fog from point A to point B when other people were chickening out. And going back to where they started, and my mom had a master's in divinity, and even though she wasn't ordained because the Catholic Church doesn't ordained women, she was hired back by the seminary to teach young men how to preach the gospel. So an interesting awakening for her to find out the gender differences between, you know, the way men are perceived by the church and by society,
right,
and the way
right.
women are perceived. And
yeah.
So, yeah, they were very interesting and good parents, I think, to me. My older brother was an actuary, a mathematical and probability specialist who sort of fulfilled my dad's dream that his sons would be scientists. And my younger brother became a Jesuit priest and was fulfilling my mom's ambition or dream that all of her three sons would be priests. And then I was like the apple that fell between the two trees. And, you know, writing songs that require sort of, if you write them out, it's a math of pitch versus,
right.
a graph of pitch versus time. It's all very mathematical. It's a quarter notes and 64th notes and, you know, third harmony, fourth harmony, fifth harmony. But the words to a lot of the songs I wrote, you know, people would say were too preachy. And mm-hmm. so I had to kind of learn to tone it down and, and you know, write love songs and happy songs a lot, and not every song could be a protest song, at least not for me. You know, maybe for Bob Dylan it could be true, but
well, your mom
at
and
least
dad
at one point.
They tried to talk you out of getting to the music industry, and they brought a musician to your house. Guy's name was, I think, was it Matt Fraley?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's an organist from a church in Baltimore. And he came out to our house in Ellicott City, which one of the towns that's flooded this year, disastrous flood, that another one of those 100-year floods that we've been seeming to have a lot of. Anyway, Matt came out and sat in the living room, and I think my parents were eavesdropping from the kitchen, and he said to me, you know, John, it's a really hard life. You really need to think about this. Musicians don't have an easy time. You have to stay up late sometimes and do a lot of traveling. You don't get to see your family. Sometimes you have to work with really strange people, and you have to constantly be practicing. You be ready because, you know, you never know when your big break's going to come. You've got to be ready for it. And I said, you know, to myself, I was saying, when can I start?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, where do I sign up? The wrong way to tell an 18-year-old or, you know, any kind of a teenager, a teenage boy at any rate, you know, not to be a musician. Like, have to leave your family and stay up late and travel a lot and hang around weird people, you know, and play a lot of guitar.
When I read that he brought in Matt Fraley, it reminded me of the SNL skit with Chris Farley as Matt Foley. You know, I live in a van by the river.
Oh, yeah.
That was so funny.
Well, I've done a little bit of that, too. I mean, I did sleep in Washington Square Park in New York City and sleep on rooftops during the summer. You know, in climate weather and park benches. And until I was able to afford an apartment or to split the apartment with my ex-wife one-time songwriting partner, Johanna, who wrote lyrics to some of the early hits and album tracks that I recorded or that Orleans recorded. But
the book has so many great stories. You know, I love the music, you know, all the stories about, I mean, you were in a band called the British Walkers. You replaced Roy Buchanan, who was one of my heroes, and a big-time guy in the D.C. area, and Bobby Howard.
Yeah, me too. I used to go listen to him play, and all the guitar players would be sitting right in front of him trying to figure out what he was doing. And he would turn his back on the audience and when he took a solo and play his secret licks to the back wall.
Well, he was awesome. Yeah.
Teddy Spelios was playing guitar when I replaced. I was kind of the replacement for Bobby Howard more. I was like, I was playing guitar and singing, but Teddy was the lead player with the 55 serial number 55 Fender Broadcaster, who was even more than I was sort of trying to emulate Roy in that band. But at a later time, I don't forget if I wrote this in the book, but. Much later, when Orleans had, I think, Dance With Me on the charts, our first top five record, Roy Buchanan opened to Orleans at a gig in New Hampshire. I think it was Keene college in New Hampshire.
Right.
And one of the state college system schools. And we did two shows, Roy opening and then Orleans closing, and he showed up with his guitar with no amp. And actually not even a case for his guitar. Mm. He's carrying his guitar over his shoulder. And came in and asked if he could borrow my amp. And I had an old Fender Super Reverb that was beat up already, you know, and I said,
right.
Roy, listen, I love you. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. I know you from D.C. I'm going to let you use my amp, but here's the only thing. Please don't turn it up more than 5 out of 10. I play it on 5,
right.
You know, and with the tone knobs on 5 and the volume on 5. Don't go over that because it's going to blow it out if you do. The speakers can't take it. They're already distorting, you know. He said, no problem, I won't. And then he turned everything up to 10 and blew my amp out.
Oh, geez.
And I had to, for my second show, I had to borrow an amp from one of the other bands on campus. I had to find a student with an amplifier.
So, oh,
you know,
man.
How our idols have fallen, you know.
He was a great performer, yeah.
He was, you know, he was living in the van by the river practically at that point.
Yeah.
And died, you know, shortly thereafter.
I know. It's a shame.
Yeah.
Other stories you had, I mean, you and Janis Joplin, you were actually coaching Janis Joplin about your song Half Moon that you wrote for her.
It was interesting.
Awesome.
I was teaching it to her and to her band, the Full Tilt Boogie Band, in the living room of her home in San Rafael, California.
Yep.
And Todd Rundgren, her musical director, quote-unquote, I think he was, because he was another one of Albert Grossman's artists and a producer and arranger and a songwriter and, you know, artist in his own right, he had been dispatched to oversee the rehearsals of the Full Tilt Boogie Band before they went on the road. And he's a good guy, and he's obviously extremely talented.
Right.
But he was, while I was trying to teach that song to them, he was behind me making faces and trying to get me to crack up. And anyway, they learned the song and did a great job on it.
Yeah. You and Duane Allman and Dickie Betts playing electric guitars with no amps.
Well, you know, you had to be there. I mean, and the amazing thing to me is that I was there.
Yep.
I look back on some of these things and go, holy cow, you know, how lucky was I? How blessed was I, you know, to be in these places at the right time? And, I was playing with Taj Mahal in the big band with the four tubas, recording two-disc LP package called The Real Thing, live at the Fillmore East and Fillmore West.
Mm-hmm.
And we played a run of colleges in the Southeast, in the Carolinas and Virginia. And the Allman Brothers were the other band. It was a co-billing, as they call it, where one night the Allmans would open and Taj Mahal and his band would close. And then the next night Taj would open and the Allman Brothers would close.
Right.
And, of course, the Allman Brothers went on to be a much bigger name, and Taj is still great. I mean, he can bring down the house with no band, but I walked into one of these college dressing rooms, which basically was bare bulbs, light bulbs in front of mirrors, and a dressing room that doubled as a theatrical dressing room, you know, so that the actors and actresses could do their makeup and put on their costumes before they went out to do whatever play they were performing in. You know, we were using those kind of same, you know, dressing rooms. And I walked by one, and the door was open, and there was Duane and Dickie, the two star guitarists for the Allman Brothers, jamming together on a 12-bar blues with their Les Pauls, just, you know, no amp, just listening to each other in the room. And so I put my case down and took out my Stratocaster and walked in the room and started playing along with them. I think it was a shuffle blues in A, as I recall. And, you know, they would each play a couple choruses, and then they'd take turns and play rhythm behind the other guy. And then they turned to me and nodded to me like, you take it. And so I played a couple of choruses of 12-bar blues shuffle with them. And then I went back to playing rhythm, and we just went around in a circle like that for what seems like, you know, 20, 30 minutes. It was just, you know, it was a jam session.
Okay,
and then when we stopped, we finished with a sort of a typical blues ending, and then I stuck out my hand and said, John Hall, I'm playing with Taj Mahal. And they introduced themselves, and you know, we went on, did our sound check, and did the show, and then the next night we were at a different college. And but it was interesting that I got to jam with the Almonds again with Dickie. At this point, was off by himself, and Dwayne, I'm sorry to say, was long gone from this planet. But Warren Haynes and Derek Trucks were playing guitars at Jones Beach at the Amphitheater Theater, the Nikon Theater there on the South Shore of Long Island. And this is when I was actually in Congress. I had I'd been elected to my first term, and I was still connected in the musical world enough that my press secretary or my media coordinator for my campaign, who also wrote music criticism for the New York Times, among other publications, and knew the Almonds and their management and so on, you know, set it up so that I could come up there. I think it must have been a Saturday night or a Friday night when I flew back from D.C. to New York, that I was able to scoot out there to Jones Beach and sit in with them. And it was actually really a challenge, first of all, because I had not been playing guitar as much as I was used to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Since being a congressman is really a 7-day-a-week, 13-hour-a-day job.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So somebody handed me a guitar, and I jumped up there for the encore and played Southbound with them. And they gave me the first solo. I was like,
really?
I was like trying to hop a freight train that's already going 60 miles per hour, you know. But I managed to equip myself fairly well, and then, you know,
mm-hmm.
All these years later, this summer we played on my birthday, actually, July 23rd, at the same theater in Jones Beach. Orleans was asked by Greg Allman to play at a festival there called the Layback Festival,
mm-hmm.
that the Greg Allman Band played at, along with Marshall Tucker Band and
right.
America and a bunch of other groups that that Greg curated, as they say. He was the person who decided which acts were going to be on this festival. And, you know, once again, a privilege and an honor and a blast to be
mm-hmm.
On the same show with Greg. And of course, I'm a big fan of the Tedeschi Trucks Band. And,
oh, yeah.
And, you know, I was maybe as surprised as anybody and impressed as anybody with how far Derek Trucks has taken
mm-hmm.
the slide guitar.
Yep.
I mean, between he and Sonny Landreth, who I
yep.
did a little clank with not too long ago up here in mm-hmm. In the woods near Woodstock, you know, they have really advanced slide guitar playing into another world from when Dwayne Allman was playing it, you know, and he was considered one of the groundbreakers. He and Lowell George, who was another friend of mine, another deceased friend of mine, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
And, but the one interesting thing about my friend Bonnie Raitt, who is not only a great singer and songwriter,
yeah.
and really
yeah.
a really righteous community
yep.
citizen and participant, every show that she does in the United States at any rate, and mm-hmm. probably overseas too, she sets aside a couple hundred tickets for whatever the local cause is that she wants to support. Sometimes it's a women's shelter. Sometimes it's a food bank. Sometimes it's a renewable energy project. And, of course, she campaigned. She and Jackson Browne and David Crosby and Graham Nash and various other my musical friends did concerts and or house parties to raise money for my campaign, so I would be able to actually run a competitive
right.
campaign for Congress in this day of, you know, million-dollar campaigns, if not,
yeah.
you know, billion-dollar campaigns. And but Bonnie is the only woman that I mean, Susan Tedeschi, bless her heart, she plays really good Strat and sort of a traditional blues rock kind of style.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of playing slide guitar, Bonnie Raitt comes on the radio,
oh,
and
yeah.
I can identify her guitar playing from the
right.
first note.
Yep.
And not just her voice, but her guitar playing. And I
yep.
think she's the only woman, you know, that I'm aware of that I can say that maybe I'm not listening to some other people that I should be listening mm-hmm. to, but I really think that's true, that, you know, I've always been able to identify Jimi Hendrix's playing mm-hmm. from the first phrase, you know, or Eric Clapton's playing.
Yep.
You know, now Derek Trucks and Sonny Landreth on slide. Django Reinhardt.
Yep.
Robin Ford, Larry Coryell. Yep. You know, there's certain people you can identify.
Right.
But in terms of women players, Bonnie Raitt is the first one that comes to mind. And as a slide player, the only one that comes to mind. So that's really quite something. And I actually, you know, I talked to her fairly frequently, and I told mm-hmm. her that the other day, and she was, like, all blushing and, you know. but, you know, it's true. And I think it's important to tell people, you know, whether it's a band you hear at a Holiday Inn that you think is really good and that it's not made it yet, but they could have a chance. You know, it's good for them to hear that from somebody who's already been down that path, you know. And
you know what I think is cool?
Whether somebody's a friend of mine like Bonnie's or a stranger, I really believe in getting up on a, you know, when they go on a break, going over and talking to the drummer or the lead player or whoever you get a chance to talk to and say, you guys are really good. You know, I hope you keep it up and just, you know, take it as it comes and be ready for your break when it comes.
You know what I think is cool is when there's a street performer and all of a sudden the artist, you know, that either, you know, wrote the song or made the song famous shows up and then starts jamming with the street performer. I see that a lot on YouTube. And I've seen Seal do it. I've seen Steven Tyler do it, you know. I think that's kind of cool.
It is. It is. And I've done a little bit of that in Europe. When I was touring with Taj Mahal, after I toured with Taj, I toured with Karen Dalton, another one of my deceased singer friends.
Unfortunately.
And whose record I played on. But anyway, we were opening to Santana on a big tour of Europe and the UK, as it was originally booked anyway. But everywhere we played, I would go out after our show ended and try to find a club with a band that I could sit in with. Because I just wanted to meet, the locals. I wanted to meet some natives and hear what they were playing and get a chance to play my licks on their songs. And they always asked me to sing blues. It was such an interesting thing to be. I mean, look, I did play with Taj, and Taj taught me a lot about blues. I've listened a lot and learned about blues and R&B. Well, you know, when I grew up in Elmira, New York, we had one pop radio station there that played every kind of music. Mm-hmm. It played Ray Charles, played Aretha Franklin, it played Johnny Cash and Patsy Cline, it played the Beach Boys, the Ventures, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and then James Brown. And then, it, you know, and then it'd go back to playing you know, Leslie Gore or Dusty Springfield or, you know, it was everything. It was me. It was country music. It was soul. It was funk. It was blues. And it was the Brill Building girl groups and the, you know, Carole King songs done by Little Eva. And then when the British Invasion and the Beatles and the Kinks and the Yardbirds and, you know, with Clapton and Beck coming through their ranks as guitar players, and the Rolling Stones, they played them too. And that was the age, I think, was in a way kind of a golden age of American music
mm-hmm.
because
things
had not yet gotten categorized and pigeonholed so that, you know, now if you want to hear only reggae, you can tune into that channel and just hear that. Or if you only want to hear traditional country, or if you only want to hear new, you know, sort of pop-sounding country. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to hear hardcore old jazz, you know, if you want to hear Coltrane and Miles and, you know, the real pure jazz, as some people call it, or if you want to hear sort of fusion jazz, or as it was called at one time, or easy listening jazz,
mm-hmm.
it's like, it's so fragmented. that a lot of people, I don't think, get the benefit of hearing all of it. And it's almost the same thing politically. I actually think it is the same thing politically.
Yeah.
That there are so many, especially with the internet, okay, but even on cable TV, you know, you can watch your MSNBC or you can watch your Fox News or you can watch, you know, different shows where you'll get one side of, you know, one picture of things. And if you go on the internet, it's even more so. And so it's the same way our musical tastes got fragmented. I think that our political points of view have been fragmented, and it might do all of us good. In fact, I try to do this myself, to listen to shows that I don't necessarily agree with to hear what they're saying.
Sure, you have
and,
to.
And that's certainly what you have to do if you're elected.
Sure.
Well, before you get elected, you probably have to do it. And if you are elected, you better be listening to all your constituents, not just the ones who voted for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to go down in history for a lot of things, but, you know, as far as a classic hits, we're always going to remember Still the One and Dance With Me, which you wrote with Joanna, right?
Mm-hmm.
Joanna? And Still the One, I always remember, it was a while ago now, but it was chosen as the theme song for the ABC TV network, you know, and they played that song a lot. It was you know, perfect. How did you come up with those two tunes? What were you...
Well, it's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. Still the One, Joanna had been asked by a friend of hers who was going through a divorce to write a song about people staying together, because she said that so many depressing songs about people breaking up.
Right.
And so Joanna wrote the lyric in its entirety on the back of an envelope and handed it to me and said, "Do you think you could do anything with this?" And I sat down with my guitar and wrote the music in about 10 minutes.
Wow.
So that was sort of the quick school of writing. And then Dance With Me started as an acoustic guitar instrumental. And I had the entire thing on the guitar with the bridge and the ending and everything. And she kept trying to convince me that it should be Dance With Me. And I was pushing her to try to come up with something that would be, in my mind, more original. But, you know, it turned out that she was right, and as the women often are. And
true.
And that, you know, it took a couple months for us to finish the lyric. You know, one day we were driving back from a gig further upstate, and she started scribbling on an envelope and going, "Pick the beat up and kick your feet up," and then was just the dam broke, and the rest of the song was written on the ride home. And but there are other ways of writing too. There's writing on demand, which I did for Broadway and off-Broadway plays.
Right.
Which is a really good skill to learn. And then in Nashville, of course, the sort of the normal way of writing down there is to have an appointment with a co-writer and show up at the office at 10 in the morning, and there's a guitar and a piano there and a recorder, tape or digital now. It was tape when I started doing it, but anyway, anything that you can record the ideas on.
Mm-hmm.
And usually each writer will come in, like sometimes there's one person who's more of a lyricist and one person who's more of a musician and a melodist, but frequently it's just two who are equal in both. And one guy will have a notebook with some ideas in it, and the other one will have a notebook with ideas or a recorder with some musical ideas, or just play them on the guitar. And then together you decide which idea you're going to work on that day. And if you really hit it off, the song's written by noon and you go out for lunch. And there's no wrong way to write a song. That's what I learned. You know, it's all good, whatever works for you. And, and of course, whatever works for the situation. Because sometimes you don't have a lot of time to finish a song, you know.
Right.
And, yeah.
Well, they're classics. I was a top 40 DJ back in the late 70s, and, you know, that was definitely part of our hit list. And they were big songs back then. You know, back in 2011, I covered the Giving Hunger the Blues Festival here in downtown Sarasota. It featured John Cafferty, and it featured Larry and Lane Hoppin.
I've done a lot of work with Cafferty, with Orleans and Cafferty.
Mm-hmm. Larry, he put on such a great show and seemed to be in excellent spirits during the concert. I got some great pictures of Larry, by the way.
Well, good.
I could share with you if you want, but it's such a shame what happened to Larry, you know?
Well, it is. It's a shame what happened to Janis Joplin.
Yep.
And Jimi Hendrix and so many, people. And what could easily have happened to me. I mean, it's very hard to know when a friend of yours or a relative of yours is close to the edge.
Right.
Because people are in denial. They in themselves might be in denial, and their loved ones are also in denial about how critical a problem is,
mm-hmm.
and how dangerous, a time it is. And, Larry had sort of a perfect storm of problems that were legal or financial or,
mm-hmm.
Marital or, band-wise. He was being sued by a former manager of the band, Orleans, and there was just a lot of pressure. And I think in addition to that he had been on medication that, his family knows more about this than I do, and I don't go out of my way to ask, but my understanding is that he was either on antidepressants or he had taken himself off of them,
mm-hmm.
which sometimes can be more dangerous than being on them. And of course, like many people of our age group, and musicians in particular, there may have been some self-medication going on, some street meds involved, and that's always dangerous, especially when mixed with any kind of prescription drugs. But I don't know. All I know is that after the fact, a lot of people went, gee, I wish I would have done something. But nobody really knew what to do. And you can't really flagellate yourself over it. The only thing I think that we all can do is to try to be more aware in the future of what's going on with our close friends and family members, and make sure that we stay in touch and reach out to them as often as we can, just as human beings, I believe that there are people like Janis, for instance,
mm-hmm.
who, if they lived today, might have survived, because back then there was not the support group network.
Right.
You couldn't find other women, for instance, who were the boss of a whole, a toll tour full of men,
mm-hmm.
The trucks and the buses and the crew and the band and so on, and she was the boss.
Right.
And Mary Tyler Moore maybe was a parallel, but it wasn't in music. She wasn't a touring singer or musician. And also I think that it was much less common then to consider detox or rehab or to attend a 12-step program.
Right. Well, the same thing happened to my best friend, and I didn't see it coming. I heard hints. There was hints of his depression, but I used to talk to him every day.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't see it coming. Just one day, it just happened. He just went out, drove to a secluded place, and he took a bunch of pills. And we knew each other since we were kids, and miss him a lot. We used to talk every day.
Yeah. So. I called Larry up. I wrote the story in the book about the hobo protester. I was coming down the stairs of the Capitol after a string of votes. They put these votes in sequences or series, so they can get a bunch of them out of the way, and then members of the House go back to their committee meetings or their appointments in their office. And so I was coming down the stairs, and this protester approached me. It was one of the guys who was out there every day, rain or shine or sleet, Mm-hmm. And he had a cardboard sign that he wrote every day, a different slogan on it with a Sharpie. And he looked like he lived under a bridge. He had a dirty old fatigue jacket on and saggy, dirty old jeans, and his hair looked like it hadn't been washed in a year. It was growing down to his shoulders. And he never said a word, at least that I heard, until this one day when I was coming down the stairs, and I heard him go, "Congressman Hall." And I turned around, and I said, "Yes?" And there's this guy that lives under a bridge with his cardboard sign. And I said, what did you want to say? And he said, "I got a message for you." And I said, "Well, you always have a message." And he said, "Thank you." And I said, "You're welcome." And then the chief of staff for another congressman from New York, Elliot Engel, came over. This guy's twice as wide and twice as tall as I am, and he was like a second in a wrestling match, you know, just in case I needed help, because things were getting kind of testy already around, you know, the political world, and it was a little bit before Gabby Giffords got shot, but I believe it was the same year, and which would be 2010, and so I had my back up there standing next to me. And the protester guy leans in and he goes, "I really love your rhythm guitar playing on Spring Fever," and which was a song on the Waking and Dreaming album that had Still the One on it. Now, I've heard a lot of people say, "I really love your lead playing," or on some song, or "I really love Still the One. I can't believe you wrote Dance With." I mean, I had a Republican congressman who I was sharing an elevator ride with in the Capitol asked me if I wrote Dance With You, and I said, "Yeah, I co-wrote it." And he said, "Well, would you sign this record for me, please?" And my wife and I had that as our first dance at our wedding, and I did sign it. Wow. And, you know, he was just all, you know, excited. And of course, I'm honored to be, you know, to be asked. But this thing with the protester, you know, he picked a rhythm guitar part, which nobody ever talks about, and an album track that was not a big hit. And I called Larry Hoppen the minute I got back to my office, and he laughed so hard he dropped the phone when I told him the story. And, you know, it's he was a wonderful partner and a terrific singer. And Still the One has a couple of pieces of magic in it that I don't think I wrote about in the book, which I maybe should have, given that Still the One's the title of the book. But we triple-tracked all the vocals on that, and at the end, when we got them done, and Larry's lead vocal put together, because we took pieces of it from a lot of different tracks that he sang, into a composite, as they say, we were listening back to it after we'd done the last vocal part, and all of a sudden we heard a dropout on his vocal track, where it sounded like a hiccup, like the way Buddy Holly used to hiccup in his songs, you know?
Yep.
"If you knew Peggy Sue, maybe you'd know how I love you." That kind of like a gasp or a hiccup in a syllable. Anyway, so at the end of the bridge, I won't torture you by asking you to find it. The end of the bridge, Larry goes, "You still the one." You know, when the back of vocals are going, "Still the one, still the one, still the one."
Yep.
He does that trill coming down off of the bridge
to
land on the chorus, and right on the downbeat, there's a dropout that sounds like he did a little hiccup. And what it was the oxide came off the tape.
Ah.
It's a, you know, the recording tape is a clear plastic with oxide on it that actually records the magnetic signal. This is analog world now we're talking, but you could see through it.
Wow.
And our engineer, Val Garay, who was doing the final mixes for us and the final edits for us, said, "Nobody will ever notice it. Let's just go ahead and mix it." And we did mix it.
Mm-hmm.
And in 40 years, this year, since that record came out, no one has ever mentioned it to me. I've never heard anybody say, "What's that funny sound in Larry's voice on that last chorus?" Yeah, it just shows how myopic you can get. You can get so close to a project that you can't see the forest for the trees. And we had no idea how big a record, how big a song that was going to be.
Yeah.
And we just were afraid that we'd ruined it.
Definitely a moneymaker.
Yeah, for sure. Put my daughter through college.
There you go.
it's a different world now with streaming audio.
Sorry to say that
a song that big and that popular does not pay what I believe are fair and legal royalties anymore, because the streaming audio channels are treated differently than an actual download or a purchase of a CD or any kind of hard product. We got a statement last year, or I got a statement from my publisher last year that included a payment for Pandora, who in a six-month period had played Still the One 1.3 million times.
Wow.
Just on that one channel alone. Oh. And I got $18 from Pandora for that.
Really?
A check for $18 for 1.3 million airplay.
You got to be kidding me. Oh, my God.
And that's going on across the board with all songwriters and performers.
That's crazy.
There are suits, lawsuits that are working their way up through the courts, and then some people are going to Congress and lobbying Congress to try to get them to revise the Copyright Act to specifically cover the digital forms of music sharing, which were not even, nobody knew the word digital back when the copyright law was written. Everything was analog, So hopefully that'll happen. But it worries me for the young bands or musicians that are coming up now.
Yep.
Some of them may be able to get a gazillion YouTube hits by, tapping on the guitar with both fingers, all 10 fingers on both hands, and balancing a ball on their nose at the same time. But, or chasing a cat around the room at the same time. But you know what I mean? It's like, you have to do something that's so outrageous that you get just huge numbers of hits, and then if you can figure out how to monetize it or sell advertising on your, or become such a big star on YouTube that you can go out and do concerts. But one of the reasons that you're seeing the Stones still touring, that you're seeing Fleetwood Mac or the Eagles up until Glenn Frey passed away.
Yeah.
And I believe Don Henley's out performing now. And
he is.
A lot of that cohort of the age group of musicians of my age and slightly older even are performing because their royalties have fallen off a cliff.
I know.
And
I know.
So it's an injustice, I think, but one that I hope will be corrected.
I've had a few your friends on my show recently, I think. Jesse Colin Young.
He's a good friend, and I played Get Together a million times.
Good guy.
Sometimes
really
with
good
him.
Guy. He's doing better from his Lyme disease, too. He's going to be out on doing not exactly a tour, but he's going to play very small venues.
Right.
He's going to be starting to do that again because he was sick for a long time.
Daryl Hall, who lives up here near me in Millbrook, he had Lyme really bad and couldn't get out of bed for a while.
Yep.
It's a bad thing. Up here, Dutchess County, where I live, is the number one county in the whole country for new infections of Lyme disease.
Really? Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Another guy you probably read, Rick Roberts, Firefall?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I talked to Rick recently as well. He's doing okay. Had some health problems as well,
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all doing good, and I do my best to keep these guys in the limelight.
Thank you for doing that.
It was the best
and
music in the
me.
World. Best music
and,
in the world.
Yeah, we've been playing a lot of gigs with Firefall the last couple of years.
Yeah.
In fact, we're doing a cruise. Orleans is playing on cruise March 11th to 15th, I think it is.
The Rock and Romance Cruise.
It's the Rock and Romance Cruise.
That's right.
Out of Fort Lauderdale. And We're
That's awesome.
Going down to Cozumel, and then I don't know where from there. But
it's a great thing. You got America,
Fireball,
Peter Frampton,
yep. America,
Christopher Cross,
Stephen Bishop.
Yep.
It goes
Ambrosia.
On and on. It's a lot of good bands and a lot of
great
good performers.
Band.
And many friends of ours.
Yep. Are you going to be on the cruise?
I will.
Good. That's a great place to...
I usually like to sail on a smaller vessel that I control myself.
Yep.
But I've been on one cruise. I went on a country music cruise that I was not performing on, but I was friends with a bunch of the performers.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 80s, but that's the only cruise I've ever been on.
Yeah.
Up until this one, which I'm...
This one's going to be great.
I'm just going to try to not gain too much weight while I'm on it.
That's hard to avoid on a cruise.
I know it is, and I've lost 40 pounds since I've been out of Congress.
Really? Wow.
Well, it's probably because, you know, I realized that my heart problems were not being helped by my weight.
Right.
And so it's partly that, but... And my younger brother, Jerry the Priest, was, or father-brother, as we used to call
him. Father-brother.
was probably 40 pounds overweight when he died. And I'm sure that they had, it didn't help, let me put it that way. But I'm really happy to be my fighting weight and my best performing weight. So I'll just try to snack and not dive into the desserts too much.
John, we got to wind down now. The current members of Orleans, it's you, Lance Hoppin, Lane, Charlie Morgan. Is it Fly Amaro?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
Fly's really a guitar player. And
Peter O'Brien,
he replaced me when I was out of the band because I was in Congress or because I was doing solo records or tours.
Right.
And then after Larry passed away, Fly and I have gotten to play together for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's been a couple of years, but we're having a great time playing together, and he knows all of Larry's parts and all of my parts. he's a great singer as well as a guitar player and writer. And he's actually, this winter, he's doing a bunch of shows solo, opening to Albert Lee, the incredible country and rock guitar player. Who's, you know, one of my heroes. And that's the band. It's the original members, bass player Lance Hoppin and myself. And then Lance and Larry's younger brother, Lane Hoppin, who has the brother harmony, that family harmony blend.
Mm-hmm.
They all grew up in the same household with music teachers for parents. And they all sang together, and they all phrase exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And I've been singing with Hoppin Brothers since 1972, so I kind of, you know, I've become an honorary Hoppin in terms of phrasing. And, you know, that's, with Charlie and Fly, that's the band, and it's, I'm really proud of the way we perform and the way we sound, and I think what we hear back from people is, you guys sound just like the band's always sounded. So, you know, it's not exactly the same band, but two of the original four are here, and everybody acquits themselves really well. It's some new material coming up as well. And
good.
Lance is working on his first solo album. Lane's going out with Charlie and Lance, sometimes backing up former member Sakul and the gang and the Daz band, and Felix Cavalieri on the road occasionally, and and Fly's got his own solo record that he just released this year, and and I've got my first book, which I'm excited about.
There you go, and you're already thinking about a second one, I think, right?
Well, I've got a couple of, well, you know, one would be sort of a follow up to this one, but the other one is a sailing book, actually, about sailing with my dad, learning to sail from my father, and different incidents that happened going back to my fifth birthday, and and on up into adulthood. It's really, you know, kind of a specialty book, but it's also, it's about a father and son and a son's relationship.
Oh, that'll be great. You actually had an album out called Rock Me on the Water, right? And released in 2005.
That's correct, yeah. That's my wife of 15 years now, Melanie, and I sailed a 39-foot sailboat from Kingston, New York, up on the Hudson River near Woodstock, down to Key West.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took the boat with a humanitarian aid mission, permission from the Treasury Department, across to Cuba, to Havana and back, to deliver musical supplies and instruments and supplies and medical supplies, all of which are exempt from the embargo, down to a surgeon in a hospital in Havana and to the conductor of the youth orchestra there. And then we sailed the boat back, about Melanie and I sailed the boat back up the coast and straight offshore from Atlantic City to Block Island and Cutty Hunk and Martha's Vineyard and back down inside of Long Island Sound and down the Jersey coast and up the Chesapeake Bay again and down up the Delaware Bay, down Chesapeake Bay to Annapolis, and sold the boat in Annapolis and then moved our possessions from the house that she had bought in Nashville 20 years earlier to a house that we bought together up here in Dover Plains, which is where I'm sitting right now.
That's what, yeah, I'm telling you, man. You are a Renaissance man.
Well, thanks. You know,
and not only that, you're a pretty good racquetball player, which is my sport.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to play a lot of racquetball. I played, you know, club tournaments and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And I had a pretty good backhand.
Yep.
Always, even, you know, ping pong was probably my first racket sport. And as a kid, I played ping pong in the fallout shelter that my dad had built in the backyard during the Cuban Missile Crisis,
mm-hmm.
In the backyard of our home in Elmira, New York. And, you know, he was, as you said, he was a classified, had a security classification for the work he did as an engineer for NASA and the Defense Department. And he would sometimes stop in the middle of a sentence and say, I can't say any more about that. And but he knew enough to be scared enough to build a fallout shelter in the 60s. And fortunately, we never had to use it for its intended purpose, but it made a great ping-pong room, and it also made a great jam band space for a garage band.
And
you had a snare drum in that concrete room. Buried under the backyard, the sound would go pow. It was like gated reverb in the 80s.
Wow.
And so,
did you ever play Vince Gill in racquetball?
I did play with Vince, yeah.
Did you beat him?
I beat him really bad. I beat him. I played Roseanne Cash, who prided herself on being, and she was a pretty good player. She was a serious player, but not at the level that I had been playing at, and so I thrashed her a few times, and she said, I'm going to get Vince Gill to come play. I can't wait to see that, you know. So she brought Vince to the Y in Nashville, and he subjected himself to my superior, at the time, game. Vince is a natural athlete, by the way. I mean, he's a really good basketball player.
That's why
you're really
good
golfer. Probably could have made it on the pro golf tour if he had chosen that instead of music. And, you know, it could with any racket sports. And I just happened to be at the top of my racquetball game.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, since then I've played a lot of tennis and done a lot of skiing and learned to be a ski instructor.
Yep.
One of the interesting things about that is you get instant feedback. It's kind of like being a musician in a way, because if you have a student or a group ski lesson where maybe during a holiday, sometimes you might have 15 or 17 people in your group, and usually on the bunny slopes because you're teaching beginners, and you get them from not knowing which end of the ski is the tip and which is the tail to knowing how to put their boots on and get them in the bindings and sidestep up the hill, and then do a little bullfighter turn to face downhill and make a wedge to stop and pull your you know, skis together to go and make wedge turns to the right, make wedge turns to the left, and stop when you want to and ride the lift, get on and get off without falling. If you can get through all that in an hour and a half with 17 people, and then later in the same day you see them smiling coming down the slope by themselves, and they're not crashing into other people or,
yeah.
or running into the parking lot by accident, you know,
yeah.
which does happen, by the way. I've chased more than one skier into the parking lot.
Did you really?
And peeled them off the side of a bus. But usually people get it. And I've always been fascinated with how information gets transferred from the teacher to the student. And learning to ski and to teach skiing is kind of like that. And if you can make an individual or a group of people happy and, you know, after an hour and a half, you know, you can watch them skiing on their own,
yep.
then you feel like, yes, I can do this. And sometimes you get a tip, too. I got a tip once for teaching a group of a family of Japanese people, grandparents, parents, and two kids, the third generation, boy and a girl. And I had them for an hour and a half, and they were going up and down the slopes and riding the lift safely. And at one point, I was standing over to the side of the slopes, and I had them with their backs to the trees
mm-hmm.
and me facing them with my back to the slopes. So if anybody got hit by an out-of-control skier, it would be me, not my students. And I was starting to explain the next thing we were going to do. You know, so on this next part of the slope, I want you to turn in a wedge turn and just keep turning until the turn stops you. You know, and as I was talking, the young boy started elbowing his sister and trying to knock her over. And,
oh, really?
And the grandfather said, "Hi, your teacher is speaking. Be silent." And they pulled themselves up and acted like, you know, they were never going to do that again.
Right.
And they didn't. But they did learn, you know. And
yeah.
at the end of the hour and a half, the grandfather gave me a $50 tip, and I went, I can make a living at this. And I know people who do make a living at it, that it's not a bad way to make a living.
It's not at all.
Sometimes you have to ski in really bad weather. But
My new son-in-law, his father, who looks like Eric Clapton, by the way, he looks just like him, is a ski instructor and for many, many years. And they go to Keystone in Colorado.
Right.
And they're going to teach my daughter. My daughter's going to Colorado in the spring of next year. And my son's going next week to Colorado.
Right. They have snow, of course.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting.
Well, you know, a good instructor can make all the difference.
Definitely.
That's what I think. I mean, the first time I tried to ski, when I was playing with Taj Mahal, we played a little college in Vermont somewhere. And they had their own ski slope. It wasn't really a mountain. It was just a slope, maybe 300 yards long or so, and not that steep a pitch, with a rope tow on it. And so the road manager was a skier from the Sierras, who I forget his name now, but the Taj's band, all had the locker room as our dressing room. And we were playing in the field house at this college. So there were skis. There were these tall skis that were taller than I am. And some lace-up leather boots and the old-fashioned bear trap bindings. And so the tour manager says, "Come on, John, I'll teach you how to ski." And like a fool, I said yes and went out there, and he basically helped me get the boots on and get the boots snapped into the bindings and said, "Now you just come over here and hold onto this rope while it pulls you up the hill, and then you can just ski down." And I fell down 20 times going up the rope and fell down 30 times coming down the hill and said to myself, "I can't ski. I must be one of those people who just can't do it." And it wasn't until my daughter was 7 and she asked me if I would come as a chaperone on a ski trip that her class was going to take to a little ski area called Cortina Valley, which was close to Hunter Mountain in the Catskills. And I decided I didn't want to deprive her. She said, "If you go, I'll go, Dad." You know, and I said, "Okay, well, I can do that." And I wound up going down behind the class, doing everything that the ski instructor said to do.
Yeah.
And suddenly I learned that I could ski after all, and it became kind of a maniac, obsessed with skiing after that.
Yeah, once you get the hang of it, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really is. And
and
instruction
is
just like with tennis or, you know, many other sports. It's,
yeah,
it's a lot quicker and less painful if you have the right instruction.
Exactly. John, I want to thank you so much for being on
the
show
today. You're
so
welcome,
Ray. And for all the great music, man. And,
you're
know,
welcome,
have fun, man. Have fun on the Rock and Romance cruise in March. That sounds like a great time.
I'm looking forward to it, and I hope we'll get to meet in person sometime.
I hope so. Maybe we can play some racquetball.
Okay, well, I haven't played in a long time, so I'm not promising anything, but
I haven't played in a while either, so we'll be even.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, John.
Well, thanks, Ray.
Take care.
Yep, you too. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Purchase John Hall's best-selling memoir entitled Still the One, A Rock and Roll Journey to Congress and Back at Amazon.com, and visit John's official website, www.johnhallmusic.com. Visit John Hall on Facebook, www.facebook.com/johnhall.memoir/. Visit Orleans' official website at www.orleansonline.com. And also for the Rock and Romance Cruise, for more information on that, visit www.rockandromancecruise.com for more information. Very special thanks to Ann Layton of Media, Music Services, Motivation for arranging this interview, and to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at PublicityWorksAgency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.